Norman Beecher, age 82, is being interviewed by Renee Garrelick for Concord's Oral History Program on November 9, 2005, at his home at 1080 Monument Street. With the approaching of Veterans Day on November 11th this year, and the 60th anniversary of the ending of World War II, it is very timely to look at the perspective of your wartime experiences. Particularly, you were very conscientious in writing letters, and you participate very regularly in the Memorial Day Parade, and I always see you regularly attending the Holocaust Memorial observances annually, which leads us to the fact that you will be talking about the liberation of the Dachau concentration camp. When the war began, you were a student at MIT, and then you enlist in the ROTC?
Yes, I did, and it was not entirely altruistic. The ROTC promised us that we could graduate before having to go overseas or into the active service, a promise which they didn't keep, but that was one of the reasons that I went in. Also, actually my father encouraged me to enlist. He had volunteered in the Spanish-American War, and he thought it was my duty, which I think is quite interesting because I don't think many fathers today would do that. The sense of having to go to war and send your son to war isn't so prevalent today.
You also obviously were hearing the shrill rantings of Hitler over radio, and what did you think of this war at that time?
Well, we had no doubts about the need for the war and the need to destroy Hitler. There were rantings, and we listened to them. We even were amused by them sometimes. One time at the fraternity, we rigged up a loudspeaker and broadcast a speech of Hitler to the hotel dance floor on the top floor that was next door to us and only about two floors higher. And we did that for about 2 hours until the police came. But, you know, making fun of Hitler, but also feeling it was a terrible, terrible thing. We didn't know anything about the killing of Jews or that sort of thing at that time. But we did realize that he had attacked lots of innocent cities and destroyed them with his dive bombers and things like that.
And you... what regiment did you join?
Well, I was in the ROTC, and I was in the Ordnance Department, which is the department that does repair of tanks and guns and equipment. And we trained in that area, and then I was sent down to Aberdeen Proving Ground, where the Ordnance Department was trained. And before I went down there, I was, went down first for basic training, and then got 3 months back at school, and then went down finally. And at that time, when I got down, I had the option, and the question was, whether I would be going to officer candidate school or going simply off in the service somewhere. And that was settled by a number of tests and interviews and some of the things that I did during training and so forth. So about half of our ROTC group went to officer candidate school, and the other half went off, got assigned somewhere in the service as enlisted men. So I went to officer candidate school, and from there was sent down to a camp in Kentucky. Let's see if I can.
That's okay.
From there, they were assigned to the 14th Armored Division. Each Armored Division has a battalion of ordnance to take care of their equipment. And the ordnance companies, one company goes with each combat command into battle and stays right behind them and takes care of the tanks, getting them off the field and repairing them. And that's what that battalion did. And we went overseas within a couple of months of the time I got there.
And where were you stationed in Europe?
We landed in Marseille. Marseille was the second front opened in Europe. It had been opened in about, September maybe, or August or September.
Of 44.
Remember, the first invasion of Europe wasn't until June of 44, mm-hmm. and that was the Normandy landing. And those troops were spreading out in Europe and going driving inland, but they hadn't got anywhere near the German border, which was north of us. So they opened this other front. The attack on Marseille was not nearly as costly as the one in Normandy because a lot of the German troops were off fighting the people in Normandy. And so it was a relatively small battle, but was done by troops before I got there. We got there in early November. That date exactly right.
No, that's fine.
And then spent a month putting our equipment in shape. When you ship tanks and guns overseas and ships, even trucks, you have to coat them with grease or they'll be ruined by the ocean spray and salt air and so forth. So we had to clean all that off. We had to assemble weapons that had been disassembled for packing purposes. Many trucks had been disassembled for packing purposes. So we put all that stuff together, tested it out, drove around in the vicinity of southern France, and then headed north. And as we headed north, we went up the Rhone, the main road through the Rhone Valley, and behind a German army, which had been destroyed by the people ahead of us, some of whom were some of our advanced combat commands. Every armored division has three combat commands. Combat Command A, B, and Reserve Command. And one or two of them took part in some of the final battles with the Germans to destroy this division. What happened was that the Germans were retreating from Marseille up the valley.
This is the Rhone Valley?
The Rhone Valley. And the Americans sent a force over the mountains, around the main road, a very difficult route, but they managed it with tanks and infantry and so forth, and blocked off the road north up high at the top end of the Rhone Valley. So the Germans were trapped, and then it was a matter of pounding them from both sides. And that took several weeks, but by the time we came up, the roads along either side were just piled with dead horses and broken trucks and artillery pieces weapons and small weapons, and even a lot of dead German soldiers, so that you can see there's been a great deal of destruction.
You also had interaction with the German population.
I did have a good deal of interaction with the German population after the war.
Oh, after the war, okay.
The interaction, well, we had a good deal of interaction with the French population because we spent until early spring of 1945 in France, trying repeatedly to break through the Siegfried Line, which was the defensive line at the German border. And every time we tried, we got driven back. It was a very heavy defense, lots of blockhouses that could come up from the ground and go back in, lots of blockhouses that were disguised as houses. And when you fired a shell at them, the house parts fell off and you saw 7-foot thick reinforced concrete with cannon and machine guns firing. It was a very difficult thing to get through. We did finally break through in late spring, and the way it was done was that the engineers, which are so-called combat engineers, strapped 50-pound packs of TNT on their backs and crawled across open fields at night with smoke blown over them, to decrease visibility, and went up to the Dragon's Teeth, which were in front of the blockhouses. The Dragon's Teeth are odd-shaped pieces of concrete which tanks can't climb over, which turn tanks over if they get to them. And they blew those up and created paths for us to get in. And then the whole division attacked, and the way they neutralized the blockhouses in general was some infantrymen would be able to get up close to them and throw a grenade through one of the firing slots. That was the only way they could get the shells falling on them. It was totally ineffective.
I see. So this is already bringing us to the spring of 45.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, we had other events. I probably should mention the Battle of Hatton, which was one of the biggest battles that the biggest battle we fought.
How do you spell that?
Hatten. Mm-hmm. It's a town in France, mm-hmm, near the German border, and it was in the middle of the Maginot Line, which is the French defensive line, much less impressive than the German Siegfried Line, but there were a number of blockhouses. And as we advanced, we were met by German forces. And these German forces were probably a spillover from the Battle of the Bulge, which had started in Belgium, earlier, and made the 101st Airborne famous. But that battle continued a long time. The Germans did advance quite a way, and they spilled over to the south and came to us. And so we were met by a German armored division and two infantry divisions. So we were met by German armored division and two infantry divisions, and we had essentially the same backing. We were the 14th Armored and a couple of infantry divisions whose numbers escape me at the moment. And we fought in Hatton, this little town in the vicinity, very small vicinity, for about 10 days. And of course, Hatton is leveled to a maximum of about 3 feet. And it was a very bloody battle. And we lost every tank. Every tank. We had an armored division at that time, had 256 tanks. every tank was put out of action, and we lost, of course, a certain amount of it from Clemson. Although casualties were not as high as you'd expect. Our total casualties during the war were only about 5%, 6%, whereas wars like the Civil War, they had 50% casualties. But anyway, we had a very bloody battle for a length of time, and I was in a forward recovery station. I was given the assignment to go forward with the attacking units and bring the tanks back for repair and that sort of thing. So I was in a little forward unit, and I was right in the middle of the artillery. And the artillery was 17 battalions, ranging all the way from 75 millimeter up to 240 millimeter. And they fired continuously for 10 days. And the result was, I had taken over a German farmhouse, fairly good sized farmhouse, for my troops to live in and to use barns and so forth for some of our equipment moving and so forth. And that farmhouse had tile roof. Every tile fell off the roof, but it was never hit by anything in whatever shell. It was just the shock of the concussion of all these artillery. So it was quite a, and that incident is what damaged my hearing considerably.
Really?
So I have not since then been able to hear very many high notes.
Now, when you were having interaction with the French population as you were advancing, do you have any observations about that?
Well, the most startling characteristic of the French was how accepting they were of their circumstances. This is war, so that's it. Nothing you can do about it. And they didn't complain. They didn't say how horrible I was. They just said, "This is war." One farmer that I was billeted with, somewhere else, I remember exactly, had a shell hit the roof of his house. It had blinded one of his sons and killed one of his daughters or something like that. And, he didn't say, he didn't express the kind of passionate grief that you think he would express. He just said, "I get it." The French were very hospitable to us. And I did have a couple of leaves, 2-day leaves, one to Paris and one to Nancy. Nancy was about 60 miles from us, and I guess Paris was a couple of hundred. At Nancy, I was taken in by a French family, and they put on the young people. There were two daughters, I think, in the family. They put on a party for me on Saturday night when I was there, and it was very interesting because, they were very friendly towards anybody who was helping out the journey, and we just had a good time. And the thing that was interesting about the French, that was different from Americans, is that every young French person had apparently been taught that he had to develop some sort of talent to show others for a party. So one boy would play his guitar and sing a song, some girl would dance or sing or something like that, or would tell a story. And so it was much more entertaining evening than I would have had in a typical American family where we would talk nonsense probably. And I felt a little bit inadequate because I didn't have anything particular that I knew how to do. But it didn't matter because they were very obviously very friendly because of my extension. Then when I went to Paris, I was standing in line to get a ticket to the opera, and this woman came along who was sort of the equivalent of the USO in the U.S., and she said, would you like to have dinner with a French family that has a nice daughter, and I'll go with her to the opera? And I said, well, I certainly would. So I went to this French family, and they had two daughters, and one of them had a date who was an American Air Force pilot, and he told me about how he had gotten acquainted with this girl when he first came to France 6 months earlier or something like that, some of the early forces had been stationed there, and he had seen something of her as much as he could. He said for the first 3 months all he was allowed to do was sit in the room and talk to her while her parents sat sort of
chaperone.
Heard everything. He said after 3 months he began to be able to take her out on a date or something like that. But of course he had to bring her in at a very early hour, like 11 o'clock and something like that. And they could only go in a couple of places and stuff. So the French were very protective of their daughters. And so we went to the opera and I went to this other sister, and the couple of the Air Force went with us, and we had coffee shop rooms. So had a good time at the opera, and it was just very nice. And the French were just always friendly. I have a lot of respect for the French anyway. They have a very sophisticated view of the world, and they're not they're not simpletons that people you meet are not given to believing a lot of trite assumptions about people. Anyway, I always had a good time with French. It isn't that I particularly preferred French or anything. I studied German instead of French when I was in school. I only studied French a little bit. It's nice to see them. I also felt very sorry for them when I saw them during the war, so we were coming through, because the French people that we saw essentially dressed in gray clothes and had gray faces and looked as they had been beaten down very much. And they didn't have enough food. Their young people had been taken to Germany as slaves, and they had they'd just been terribly mistreated by the Germans. And of course all the Jews had been rounded up. With, I may say, some of the complicity of French, who were willing to do that to spare themselves.
Well, that's a very meaningful contact, you know, that you had.
Yes.
Now you are in Germany. It's the end of the war, or approaching the end of the war.
Well, we after Hatton, we were still beating our heads against the Siegfried Line, mm-hmm. and that went on for some time. And I don't know, maybe March of 45, we managed to break through the Siegfried Line, and then we got up to the Rhine, and that was another barrier. And we didn't attack across the Rhine with pontoon boats or anything like that. By the time we got to, had been there a little while we were able to go north few tens of miles and cross on a bridge which other Army divisions have established at Würzburg and in Germany. And we crossed the Rhine there, and then we went on into Germany. We had very many battles taking towns. We took an enormous number of towns. The history of the division says we took 1,000 towns, and that was both in France and Germany. And of course, some of them were very small. Some of them were big cities. We had a big battle at Lohr, which is in beyond it, was some distance beyond the Rhine. And there we essentially had to pretty well burn the town and just firing at people who were shooting at that second town and fire. And we lost 26 tanks in that one battle, a day or so. But that's the way we when we came to a place with a lot of resistance, is just grind through. We didn't do any maneuvering or flanking, we just went straight at it. Because the Germans were weakened at that time, and we didn't have to hold up that much. So the we went on, and later on, I suppose in the middle of April, or it was very near the end of the war, and we were getting quite a way in, then people would come out from the towns and offer to surrender and say that the SS were holding strong points, and they would say, and they would tell us, there's a German gun in that church steeple there, and so we knocked the church steeple down, and they say there's a German gun in that house there, and we blow that house up, and that way we would eliminate the resistance, which was generally, a small group of SS, and then the town would surrender happily. They didn't want any more destruction.
How did you communicate language-wise?
Well, I could speak German reasonably well, but I'd learned it in school. I'm sure there were people in the division who spoke German when these people had come out to communicate.
So basically, they wanted it over.
They wanted it over, and it was really foolish for the German command to continue resistance, because they didn't have anything to resist with anymore. They had few guns here and there, and a few thousand troops. We had divisions with heavy armor and artillery on armored vehicles, on armored artillery carriers. We had great deal of infantry. We had all the weapons that a modern division had, and it just wiped out anything. It just, it did cost us some people, because you can't completely neutralize everybody that's firing at you until after you identify where they are, because they shot at you. When they first shoot at you, maybe get somebody killed.
When you're in the midst of battles like that, obviously, you didn't grow up thinking you could kill somebody.
No.
Is it so overwhelming, self-defense?
I didn't have the slightest concern about killing anybody, and I don't. Maybe I was brought up the wrong way, but I never actually killed anybody directly myself. Mm-hmm. Being in the ordnance, we rarely got close enough to the front to see the enemy. I got shot at a number of times, and I saw the people who were shooting at me, mostly airplanes. So sometimes a machine gun or something with some pistons. But the only people who really had a chance to get scared and to worry about maybe killing people that bothered them was the people in the very forward units. You know, the very small handful of the army is right at the front. One tank really is at the point, and that tank is the fellow who really gets the butterflies in his stomach. And we could hear on our radios the commander of that unit, that company commander, ordering the forward tank to move out, you know, and we knew that the tank commander was feeling a little reluctant because he was going to be the center of attention of the Germans very quickly.
So you were armed, but you weren't shooting at anything.
No. The only the modern war is operates even that is not modern, but even at that time, you didn't really have a chance to get scared before you got killed. Good example was one of my buddies, another officer in our company, was shaving one morning, and a shell came in and took him away. He had no warning, didn't kill anybody else in the division or in the company, but he was gone, just like that. And when I was in this forward unit at the Battle of Hatton, I wasn't worried. I had the feeling we were going to win, and I didn't realize how seriously we were being damaged. Mm. We didn't have enough force to hold, and after 10 days we fell back 20 kilometers. We could have fallen back in a rout, and I could have been killed with the retreating troops, but it never occurred to me. I went over, from the time I got over there, like most of the troops, I figured I might get killed. But the most likely thing was I was going to live forever, which is what young people feel.
And how young were you when you went over?
I was about 44, I was 21. Mm-hmm. But that's still young enough to think you're going to live forever.
Sure, sure. Then you were making your way, was it at that point that you go to Dachau?
Dachau was very near the end of the war. I'd say probably the very end of April. And we had been moving steadily at a rapidly increasing rate. We moved as much as 20 miles a day, and that's a lot for an army division. You know, the tanks don't go very fast if they're keeping them in good shape. They can run, I don't know, run 30 miles an hour probably in good terrain, but you wouldn't drive much faster along the road. You move on. And of course, you have to slow down whenever you came to the town, make sure they weren't going to shoot at you. So as we got on, we were taking towns, we had a number of divisions with us. The 99th Infantry was going. Some of the 99th Division Infantry rode into Dachau on our tanks. And we were the only, according to what I found out later, we were the only division that reported the opening of Dachau to Army headquarters. Which seems strange because the 42nd was ordered to take it, and 42nd Infantry, and we weren't. But anyway, so we simply came to Dachau along with the direction we were moving, and we got there. As I say, the 42nd was ordered to take the camp, and they did.
You knew there was a camp there.
No, and maybe the 42nd did. I never knew it. Whether anybody else in our division did, I don't know. We knew that all through Germany there were camps with people being imprisoned. We had opened a dozen work camps where the people were in very, obviously very badly treated. And I can, if you gave me a whiff of the work camp now, it would immediately bring back memories to me, because they had this distinctive odor of sort of damaged human beings. I don't know whether it's people wearing the same clothes for several months or what it is, but the camps had a distinctive odor. And when we got to them, the people that were there were so happy. They would be absolutely ecstatic being released, as you can imagine. We never stopped to observe that except one time. And one time we spent a night near one of these camps. And these people, despite the fact that they were so emaciated and looked weak and so forth, they danced and sang all night.
Really? Amazing. Now, was that a work camp?
It was a work camp.
Okay, so it wasn't a death camp.
No. Like we never, the only death camp that I that our group was involved in was down Dachau. And I only went to the main camp, although, as I told you, I learned later that there were many, I think a couple hundred satellite camps around Dachau.
And as you show me in that overall picture, this is a very large area.
It was a very large area, and it contained not only the camp where the people were kept in the prison units, barracks, very crowded barracks and so forth, surrounded by walls, but also an SS training unit. Now, I didn't know this at the time. As I approached the camp, I saw it at ground level. I only saw one piece of wall and one compound as I entered. Now I know that there was an SS training camp, and that's what the 42nd Infantry Division fought with when they came there, and they took several hundred prisoners, and many of them SS. And incidentally, when I got to the camp and went to what I thought was the main entrance, it was certainly an entrance, a main entrance, I was told by the soldiers there regarding the American soldiers regarding the entrance that people in this division that took the camp saw what was there in terms of dead bodies and terrible conditions and so forth. One lieutenant lined up what they said was 22 guards against the wall and shot them with a machine gun, and that the lieutenant was going to be court-martialed. So that's all I knew from that time on. Much later I learned that the lieutenant was relieved of his command, sent back to the States, and so was the commander of the battalion or division, I can't remember for sure. But anyway, the responsible officers were all sent home, and the thing was taken under advisement for investigation by the Army legal authorities. And much later I learned that it had all been kept top secret and had not been released until 1992, and then during that time nobody had been actually charged. The division commander, the battalion commander, had actually risen to the rank of brigadier general, and the lieutenant just went back to private life. But it was a shocking scene, and when I came in, what I saw was most dramatic was four railroad cars in this compound of a, apparently a longer train, because I could see the next beginning of the next car poking out from behind the building. But these four railroad cars were essentially wooden box cars, and they had the doors open. A door in the center, and inside had been stacked bodies very neatly. What I could see, it looked as though the heads were all stacked in the same direction, and through the doors a number of bodies had slipped out onto the ground, and there were just stacks of bodies on the ground, maybe 10 or 15 bodies in a stack, and you know, several hundred in each car, maybe a couple hundred in each car. And they were very white and very emaciated and very straight. They, you know, I've never seen bodies like that before. I've seen many people killed and lying on battlefields, but never like that. And these people looked as though they had been straightened out before they died or something like that.
And where were they taking the bodies?
Pardon me?
Where were they taking the bodies?
I don't know. They hadn't moved any out of Poland. Where had the Germans been taking them?
Mm-hmm.
I suspect they shipped them in from somewhere else to be cremated at Dachau.
Oh, I see. They were bodies that were being brought to Dachau.
Well, it's only a guess.
A guess, yeah.
But I can't see any other reason. They could, of course, been being shipped out of Dachau to somewhere else, because mm-hmm. Dachau may have been killed in a gas chamber or something and taken out. But my guess was they had come in, and because the Americans had captured the place, they hadn't been able to cremate them yet. Apparently,
mm-hmm.
Dachau was running its cremation facilities right up to the last minute. They
didn't really
do as good a job as they could.
What was the role of your division? What was your assignment? To liberate?
Our division was to essentially capture territory straight ahead of us. And we were given, I'm sure the division commander was given assignments of which towns they would take and exactly the direction they'd go. But down at our level, we only knew that say Combat Command A, we were assigned to be with Combat Command A for this particular time. Combat Command A commander knew that he had to go to town A, B, C, and D and take them all in the next 24 hours if possible, and then he would move on to other assignments. But we essentially rolled through southern Germany at the head of the troops, because the armored division is always in the front, because that's the hammer that mm-hmm. Strikes.
So Dachau was a point on your way.
That's all it was.
Yeah.
And from my personal point of view, I didn't get to stay in Dachau. I mean, mm-hmm. I had to go on to other places where our division was moving.
And when you had arrived at Dachau, there was another division that had already opened the camp.
When I personally arrived in Dachau, I think that the 14th Armored and the 99th Infantry probably arrived on the side of Dachau where I saw this train full of bodies, mm-hmm. at the same time that the 42nd Infantry was arriving on the other side where they fought battle with the SS.
Okay.
But we were all in this battle group together, moving ahead.
Mm-hmm.
At the level of lieutenant, you don't get the full big picture.
Mm-hmm.
You get little pieces of it. I did work as a liaison officer for a while. This was an assignment where you go around with your chief and go to company headquarters one's on the front line, one's further back, and find out what their plans are and bring information to division headquarters, bring orders from division headquarters down to them. Then I saw a little more of the big picture, but generally speaking, I haven't got time or information to brief a lieutenant about the battle picture.
This was something you could never have imagined. You know, you were seeing war, you were seeing the ghastliness of war for a while, but this was something else when you passed at a Dachau.
Right.
A perversion that...
Yeah, I saw the battlefield where the 13th Armored Division, one combat command of the 13th Armored Division was wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
They had gone into a valley without proper reconnaissance, and on one side of the valley was a railroad track on top of an embankment, and behind that embankment were Germans with 88mm guns. The 88mm could penetrate our tanks, and so when they got in there, the Germans attacked them from the side and the rear, and simply wiped out. And I saw these 100 or more tanks scattered around the valley, people who had tried to escape from them, their heads burned off and arms and legs burned off and so forth. A really terrible sight, but it was a different sort of picture. This is what I expected in the war.
Mm-hmm.
But Dachau, seeing these strange white bodies all piled in a railroad car, was really very shocking. And that's what, I mean, I don't mean to say that it had a deleterious effect on me. I wasn't, I didn't break down and cry or get traumatized so I couldn't sleep or anything like that. It just, you know, seemed quite...
Yeah, like what was...
When I got in there, I had my camera in my hand. I'd taken a picture at the gate outside, but when I got in, I couldn't bring myself to take a picture because it just seemed sacrilegious to take a picture of this. I don't know what the... I wish I had taken a picture, because it turns out there is no such picture. Nobody took this picture, and they should have. It's a dramatic example of what that camp was all about.
Mm.
There's nothing there there's nothing in the archives that I've been able to dig up. I've been working at it for a couple of months, that come even close to showing this sort of thing. But
there were a few other pictures that you got out of the archives.
Yes, yeah. I got mm-hmm. some pictures from the National Archives recently.
Mm-hmm.
One shows maybe 100 of these white straight bodies laid out on the ground, and the caption for the picture says that these bodies were shown to newsmen. Now, whether they laid them on the ground to show the newsmen or whether they'd just been unloading them from the train or not, but I feel sure these were the same bodies that were in the train, not all of them, but mm-hmm. a sample.
There is like an eerie efficiency,
yes.
You know, in...
Right. Even having them laid out straight on the ground like this is certainly kind of horrible.
Now, the civilians were brought in to clean up the camp?
Well, that's what they were there for. What the Army did is said, we're not going to spend our time burying bodies. The damn Germans can do it. And so they... rounded out all the males they could find in the town and had them come to, ordered them to show up at the walk to the gate of the camp, which they did. And there were about 10 or 15 of them there, sort of forming a platoon when I was there. They were, of course, not generally very young. They were farmers and people like that. either had been exempted from the war because of their farming needs, or needs of Germans for farmers, or were too old or something like that. Because you can believe that every able-bodied young German was either in the army or already dead. Mm-hmm. There's a very few men that learned after the war.
How do you separate your feelings towards the German population and the Nazi killing machine?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't separate it entirely because, especially now that I've read a lot about the Holocaust, the Germans were involved, and a lot of Germans acted in their job, and the mindset was such that they thought they were doing the right thing by killing Jews. They really felt that was perfectly justifiable operation. I have seen a picture in recent years that a German soldier sent home to his family to show what a fine fellow he was, of him shooting a German woman with her baby.
A Jewish woman.
A Jewish woman. And he felt that was the right thing to do. And that was incredible. So
they didn't feel the German Jews were part of their population?
No. They felt they were completely... there's a quote from Hitler about the Jews that they were left alone, they would suffocate in their own offer, or something like that. The terrible things. And that was the opinion of the country. Anyway, I realized that the people that I met, and I did meet some very ordinary, pleasant Germans after the war. Those people obviously had this mindset, and they had supported Hitler and so forth. And they recognized that they had been defeated, that Hitler had been defeated. I don't think they had completely changed their mind. I think many, many Germans changed their minds later. But when I knew them, they probably didn't. We didn't talk about that. I think you can... I accepted them as they were, and I occasionally talked to one of the men about how they felt about Hitler. And they would say, well, Hitler was good for the country, and he shouldn't have gone to war or something like that. That was his big mistake. But to talk about the fact that he was this depraved, insane character, that
they didn't see him like that.
They didn't see him like that, and even after the war. But, the Germany has actually done very well re-educating these people. They tried very hard.
Mm.
I was in the Reichstag in Berlin quite a few years ago, 20 years ago, and they had turned it into a museum. And in one corner they had a movie theater where they were continuously running pictures of the Holocaust, Kristallnacht, and all these events were pictures of concentration camps and things like that. All these things that were... And you'd see Germans coming out weeping.
Mm. But that wasn't true when...
No, it wasn't true when I was there.
Yeah.
No, and I just accepted these people as where they were. And I don't know is the it's hard, it's hard to hate a whole group of people anyway, but it's also hard when you see people pleasant and friendly and so forth to blame them for the sort of thing that give them the collective blame that they probably deserve. Anyway, I didn't. I just treated them like any other people.
And so the war was over, your division stayed on?
My division stayed on for a few months. Of course, it took a long time to get, 6 or 7 million troops on it. And what they did is they sent the people that had the longest combat duty on first. So that included all the people, for example, who served in Africa before coming to Europe. And I didn't come over, I didn't serve until overseas, until after Marseille had been taken. So there were lots and lots of American troops who had longer service records than I, so I was going to be one of the longer.
You had come over in 44.
I came over in 44. Well, people, of course, all the people that had been coming to Normandy had been training in Britain a year or two before that.
What did you come over in about August?
I came over a little later. I think we came over in about October. Marseille wasn't. I can look up the dates.
That's all right. It's several months after the invasion.
Several months after the invasion of Boston, and a couple of months after the invasion of Marseille.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not going home right away, and first I stayed in my division and things went on just normal. And then my division was ordered to pack up and go home with all the long service people around, and some other long service people were transferred to it to fill up the vacancies. But I was transferred to the 4th Armored, which was Patton's division, and that one was going to stay. And I was there for a while. And
did you ever meet Patton?
I never actually saw Patton, I think. I may have seen him once. During the war, we were alongside the 4th Armored for a while, and I think I may have seen him inspecting his tanks one time. Hard for me to remember at this point. I have this impression I did, but I'm not sure whether I am making up that recollection or not. Anyway, we served alongside him for a while. And of course, he was also assigned to occupation duty, and he was assigned command of the sector in which I was located at. He was a very bad commander for that sector. He gave out orders that the Germans had to step off the sidewalk whenever they met an American.
Yeah.
That they had to tip their hat to an American flag every time they saw one. He just passed a lot of small kneeling orders, which were completely unnecessary. He didn't do anything to improve the attitude of the Germans at all. Probably made them worse.
It was a vengeful.
It was a vengeful sort of thing.
Yeah.
And the occupation was full of corruption. It ran all right, but the officers who were in command of the community, for example, and these weren't always military officers who'd been in the war. They were sometimes people who trained and specialized, sent out from the States after the war or near the end of the war to help govern the occupied territory. I think there were probably more of those than there were military people. But they found that it was very easy to get a nice house, servants that they wanted, a nice German girl for a bed companion, all without exerting themselves very much, and just using their position to take these little bribes, and pretty much did. And they were been very inspiring. You know, things gradually got better because things become more civilized as time goes on. The wartime ethos of what the hell, going away, and so on.
Well, it certainly, your experience in the war certainly left a lasting impression, and your perspective at the end had to have been different.
Yes. Yeah. I certainly, two things that are very interesting. When I was training, I could understand how Hitler could get these young men to volunteer for the army. It was fun. I enjoyed taking a rifle and charging forward, firing, throwing myself on the ground and so on. It was good sport. It was a game. And I wouldn't mind having machine guns fired over my head. But, you know, again, this is a game. And it's sort of like boys playing with toy guns and that sort of thing. And I think, and then also I had the same sort of patriotic fervor that the Hitler youth had. Mm. And they were thinking that they were going to improve the situation of the Third Reich and make Germany great and so on and so forth. And I felt we were going to do a great noble deed in getting rid of Hitler, so I felt enthusiastic about going to war. And so I can understand how the Germans felt the same way. It's really sad that this is, that people react this way and they can't understand the significance of what they're doing and where they stand. And then the other thing that was surprising to me was how relatively peaceful it was very close to the front lines. The only thing that reminded you of the fact that you might be killed next minute was that there were machine guns firing and artillery firing, few shells landing, and that sort of thing. And there were a few people up there in the front who were taking the brunt of it. But just a little way back, we didn't know there was anything that happened. And then one night, when we were in the city of Severn, which is in France, Germans were firing a long-range gun at us, and it hit the barracks where one of our companies was located, and killed 13 men and seriously injured 11. And my good buddy, Lieutenant Eagleton, was in that company. He was not killed, he was not injured, but that was a heavy blow, and just out of the blue. First shell of the night. When this long range gun fired, we would generally go down to the basement. I was quartered in the French house at that time, as were most of the officers. And the enlisted men were quartered more together in a larger building of some sort than maybe in the house. But it was very surprising. You're not terribly scared that all of a sudden something happens and there you go. It's really all sort of a long range and mechanized way of doing it. Of course, the war in Europe was probably quite different from the war in the Pacific. The war in the Pacific was more like Vietnam, where you're charging into the jungle and you hear the machine gun firing right at you and the bullets are going by you. Larger number of troops, I think, in that sort of situation than they did in Europe. In Europe, these guys in the front line were foxholes that were firing back. And then they'd move very easily. There was no trench warfare, nothing like that. Getting up tanks and go and overrun the Germans. And occasionally the Germans would overrun them. But it wasn't a question of sitting around in a trench and taking shell fire and And of course, a lot of our finding was in cities and towns, and that was just a question of angst, going down the streets, and if there was no opposition, they'd be right on through the town, and the infantry would be following behind and take possession, and look around for any remaining German military, and if they were not, then off we go. There were, you know, there were a lot of occasions where we bypass enemy, and they eventually surrendered. When we went through the Siegfried line, one of my men was poking around in one of the go boxes and stumbled upon a major general.
Oh my.
Well, you know, they could have, just one kid who did it, he could have, they could have shot him, I suppose, but they were not in the mood to shoot him, and eventually get shot themselves. They were quite happy to surrender.
Yeah.
And which they did.
I suppose there was also a degree of fanaticism where, though most of the population wanted to surrender, there was an element that...
The SS, of course, were these fanatical people, and they were the ones that carried on the last ditch resistance. The ordinary German, I think, was sick of it.
Yeah.
Realize we're going to lose. So, you know, before the end of the war, Hitler had already committed suicide. So that anybody that heard of that must have known that definitely things were over. And
you heard of the news?
Yes, it was very big news.
Yes, it was very big news, and appeared in the Army newspaper, and I actually have a copy of that issue, which I'll show you on the way out. Big headlines, Hitler dead. I don't remember just exactly when that was, but probably late April of 45. You know, the war was over on May 8th. That's when we officially got the word, which is another interesting thing, the way the troops didn't react. My men didn't do anything different that day than they'd done every other day. Not only my men, but the combat troops that were all around us. They were just tall, women, about nothing, polishing their tanks, checking their weapons and so forth and things like that. And not acting as though anything had happened. I was really amazed. And all the time, the space was going wild. There were parties in the streets and so on, and Times Square was there. But our people were just calmly taking it, you know. They just felt so different. But not rising to...
a celebratory.
I'm sure they felt just the way I did it. Isn't this great? It's just terrific, you know. Here we are. Nobody's going to get killed anymore. We'll get home, and so on. And yet, they just didn't come out somehow. And they didn't. A lot of them didn't bother to listen to any of the speeches of the leaders, like Churchill and Roosevelt. Not Roosevelt, Truman. And so on. I think it was Truman. I'm not sure when Roosevelt died.
Yeah, Roosevelt died April 12th.
Yeah, so it was Roosevelt who announced the end of the war. So he gave a speech at the end.
Truman.
So a lot of people didn't listen to that. I can't remember. I don't think I heard. I certainly didn't hear all of them. I may have heard one or two of them. but we just had a different sort of feeling somehow. We're not going to celebrate. We're just going to be very, very thankful.
And you're turning out for the Memorial Day parade. You know, that's significant to remember.
Well, I didn't march in Memorial Day parades for a long time. And finally, and David Little, who was an ardent supporter of the Memorial Day parade.
Yes, he was.
Kept asking me to do it. And then he died. And I said, I'm going to do it because he asked me. And I've been doing it ever since then.
So this was after he died?
After he died. The year after he died is when I started.
It's very interesting, yeah. And I noticed that you come to the Holocaust Memorial.
Well, I'm a member of the Human Rights Council, and I got on that because I mentioned at, forget it was, some meeting of the Human Rights Council where I happened to be. I mentioned that I had opened up DACA, and they asked me if I'd join the Human Rights Council. And I said, yes, I would. I certainly want to do everything to oppose prejudice and racism. And seeing Dachau is one thing that inspired me to feel that way. So, yeah, I think the Holocaust Memorial is a good idea because I don't think we can afford to forget. There are already people, there have been over the years, people who deny the Holocaust and say it never happened. And there was a lot of prejudice in the world at that time against Jews, quite apart from Hitler. And in this country, there's a lot of anti-Jewish prejudice. And it's gotten much better in recent years. I think, Concord having a synagogue now, where I don't think we could ever have had a synagogue 50 years ago.
Really?
I think, people just wouldn't have stood for it, having all these Jews around it.
This is in Concord,
which is a fairly enlightened community. When we first came to town,
what year was that?
55. We were looking for a place to live, looking for a house lot, actually. I guess we had, we actually bought a house in Canaanum very early, very fast. I was teaching at MIT. Had been in charge of a practice station in New Jersey and had to come back here and teach at the Institute, so we had to get a house quickly. Came up here and the first weekend I bought a house there in Canaan, which came on the market. And but then we were there and we thought we wanted to move to a house in town, perhaps build our own house. And we kept looking for a lot. And so during that first year, we were offered various places. And finally, one of the realtors who we've been doing business with said, had a wonderful opportunity for you. There's a nice lot here. It's got frontage on a small pond. It's a beautiful view. And it's going to be a very reasonable price because the owner has an offer for the Jew and he doesn't want to have the Jew get it.
And that was right here
on
Monument?
That was right here in Concord. That was in 1955 or 6.
Wow.
We didn't take it, but some other person probably did, and they probably did get it at a good price because.
Oh, I see. You didn't take it because
it
was very offensive.
I suspect that what was very expensive for us in those days was pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine it was a good buy because this fellow had this anti-Jewish prejudice.
Mm.
But I don't think that sort of thing would ever happen today. We've gotten way beyond that.
Right.
And of course, we've had a lot of Jews in among the selectmen of Concord.
So when you arrived in 1955, there were just very few Jewish people.
As far as I knew.
Yeah.
The one of the problems with Kanana was expressed by a woman that I sat behind at a school meeting when Kanana was built. Then there were enough people in that vicinity so that they wanted to build the Willard School.
Mm.
The Willard School was built, and that took people from Kanana. And also, because of the way things were getting crowded on this side of the river, they wanted to transfer some people from the Office School to the Willard School. And that was done. The children who lived over on this side of the river went to the Willard School. And there was a meeting at the school to explain this and all that. And some of the people from the side of the river were also transferred to the West Concord School. So this woman sitting ahead of me at this meeting finally near the end said to her companion next door, "Well, I wouldn't mind being having my children go to school in West Concord with all those washerwomen's children, but I can't stand to have them go to Willard School with all those Jews from Kanana." There were a few Jews in Kanana.
But there was an illusion that there was many more than a few.
Yes, and the illusion, of course, I don't know how many Jews there were in Kanana. I never knew
right.
whether a person was a Jew or not.
Right.
But Kanana Jews, if they were Jews, and their colleagues certainly did a wonderful job. You know, Kanana has 3 Nobel Prize winners.
Really? That's impressive. That's
for a community unit of 100 houses, to have 3 Nobel Prize winners is certainly a record.
Do you remember their names?
Well, one is Bob Solow, who is economics, and I think that the physics man was Lynn Loomis, but I'm not sure. And the third fellow was another economist, I think, and I can't remember his name.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I'm probably wrong, but again, I can look up those for you if you'd like to have them for the history. It is an interesting historical point.
Mm.
And, you know, Kanana was essentially started by young MIT and Harvard faculty. And they had a very good intention. They had a good architect. They did a nice job of laying it out. They had a few little quirks that didn't make it always work. One was that the when the cement trucks came in to pour the foundations, they were met by a civil engineer with testing equipment to see if the cement was good quality. And it didn't always pass, and the cement trucks were sent back. Well, little things like that that sort of raised the cost.
Too many engineers.
Finally, they went bankrupt. And a vice president of MIT by the name of McLaurin bailed them out with his personal money, which was very nice. But
how long did you live in Kananta?
6 years.
Oh,
and then we had the opportunity to buy this house.
Yeah.
It was such a fabulous place. We mortgaged everything we could. Even took a second mortgage.
Oh, certainly worth it. Beautiful view. Mm. I want to thank you.